It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. President Trump is promising more strikes on Iran as the U.S. and Israel step up their military offensive that started over the weekend.
The initial attacks killed leaders of the current Iranian regime, and in the days that followed, six U.S. soldiers have died in retaliatory strikes from Iran.
As the conflict escalates, we're looking at the impact it has on Wisconsin and the Iranian Americans who live here.
Sona Kazemi is an assistant professor in the Department of Race, Gender, and Sexuality Studies at UW-La Crosse. She grew up in Iran. She has a new book that documents disability stories from her childhood in Iran. It's called Disabling Relations, and the book focuses on disabilities caused by violence, torture, and other human atrocities. Sona, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you for having me.
What was your reaction when you heard the news of the first strikes and the death of Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei?
Mixed emotions, to be honest with you. On the one hand, I want to mention that my grandfather is visiting with us right now this weekend, and he's 90 years old. And my mother, who is 60, and my son, who is 3 and a half, four generations of Iranians, we celebrated together. We were crying, we were laughing. At the same time, when we, when you hear that some civilians have been hurt, obviously that is horrible. But at the same time, when we heard that he was dead, the truth is that everybody was celebrating. It was a moment of disbelief.
So now, what does the potential toppling of this Iranian regime mean for you and your Iranian loved ones?
Well, I mean, this is a dream for all of us. I don't think there is probably an Iranian somewhere inside Iran or in the diaspora where 8-9 million of us live, has a dream bigger than the toppling of the Islamic Republic and sending it to the dustbin of history. We have suffered so much for the past 47 years under this regime, and we have been at war with this regime. That we have been doing everything in our power. We have gone to, ballot boxes. We have organized. We have gone to prison. We have done anything civic to basically establish the rule of law and democracy in our country. And every time we have met with bullets and we have gone home in body bags. So the fact that, the dream of an Iran that is not run by the Islamic Republic, but by a diverse and democratic representation and with the rule of law, is just a dream for us. But for the first time, it seems like it may be a possibility because Iranian people's aspirations and struggles are getting somewhere with all the sacrifices that we have made. Like past month, 40,000 Iranians were massacred, were mowed down by this regime's killing machine. So we are already dying. We are already sacrificing, and we have been for so many years. But it looks like we might get somewhere this time with some help from the outside world, with the international community that we have been crying for.
Let's talk about the outside world. Those who oppose the war say the U.S. and Israel should not intervene with military action in Iran, saying there was not imminent danger to the U.S., among other arguments. What role do you want the U.S. to be taking in all of this?
Well, I understand that every country operates in their own national interest. Obviously, U.S. and Israel have their own national interests to take care of. But when it comes to the Iranian regime, I want you to understand that since I was 7 years old at school, on the anniversary of the hostage taking of the American embassy, we were forced to stomp on a burning Israeli and American flag as children and wish them dead. And I had never known an Israeli or an American in my life. And with the uncertainty, I was pondering, why should I stomp on this flag? Isn't that disrespectful to stomp on somebody else's flag? And also, I don't know anybody who is American or Israeli. Why should I hate them and wish them dead? This is the confusion that this regime tried to indoctrinate with us Obviously, they were not successful because we are a nation of poetry and compassion. And obviously, that they didn't succeed in indoctrinating hate. But I want to be very specific, very clear about this. The Iranian regime's mission has been to destroy the America and Israel, and even to take over the Middle East with its own Shia ideology over other Muslims. When I was a child, when they would bring back the bodies of the martyrs, the poor Iranian soldiers that had been killed in the Iran-Iraq War, which for the 3 years was a defense, but for the rest of it, the next 5 years was just a war of aggression against Iraq. The slogan that they would chant on the streets was, "The road to Jerusalem goes through Baghdad."
Hmm.
So this was their imperial imperialist tendency and ideology to take over the Middle East, the so-called axis of resistance, surrounding Israel by its proxy forces. Why? We don't even share a border with Israel. Why should Israel be our enemy? Yet I support the Palestinian people and their cause, but I don't understand the animosity towards the state of Israel from the Islamic Republic of Iran, which has no legitimacy in and itself in its own country and wants to export its revolution and Shia ideology that has brought upon people in the region nothing but misery. Look at Yemen.
I just want to jump in here for just a moment. Sona Kazemi Absolutely. Is with us. She grew up in Iran. She is a UW La Crosse professor. You grew up in Iran in the 80s and 90s, as you mentioned, the aftermath of the Iran-Iraq War. What do you remember about that time, and how did that shape your career and who you are today at UW La Crosse?
That's a very good question. I actually, when you asked me the previous question, I wanted to mention Iranian people are as long as history. As you know, we are one of the first civilizations on mm-hmm. Earth, and we have seen so many things, and, you know, wars, revolutions, you know, national uprisings. And we lived through the longest war of the 20th century, Iran-Iraq War.
Mm-hmm.
I was born during the war. In fact, my mom went into labor hearing a bomb during the bombardment of the cities. I was born prematurely and early, and bombs were my birth song. We used to hide in the basement. Nobody knows war as well as the Iranian people. And see how desperate Iranian people should become in the hands of this illegitimate, murderous, fascist regime, that they come to a point where they say, you know, we need outside help to topple this regime and free ourselves. And there's nothing wrong with that. If you look at history, there are multiple examples of that where outside help has been successful. And obviously, Iranian people want their own self-determination and to be able to choose their next democratic government. But I also want to say that Iranians are not warmongers. Iranians are desperate, and Iranians have sacrificed everything in order to get rid of this regime. Remember that last month, 8,000 people were blinded by this regime, 40,000 dead, 50,000 arrested, hundreds and thousands in prison. I have several family members who are medical doctors, and it's so difficult for them to describe the situation that they often have burst into tears trying to explain what has happened.
Sona, I want to get your take on Saturday. A U.S.-Israeli missile hit an all-girls elementary school in southern Iran, killing at least 175 people. The Trump administration has neither ruled out nor admitted responsibility for the attack. You're a gender and disability researcher. How do you process these war atrocities and the toll on women and young girls in particular?
Absolutely. I'm so glad you brought this up. Obviously, I was one of those girls. You know, I am an Iranian little girl who went to school, you know, under gender apartheid schooling system of the Iranian regime, which is segregated. It is horrific to see that those lives are lost, whether in the hands of, you know, Iranians, because I know that it hasn't been verified. We don't know if it's Iranian misfire or Israel or U.S. Strike. First of all, I want to say that this school was built near a military establishment. So, and we know a long history of how the regime uses the civilians as a human shield. We have seen it in other parts of the world, like Hamas does the same thing because it has been funded by the Islamic State and the same ideology. But I also want to say that after the Women Like Freedom movement, 1,200 schoolgirls were deliberately poisoned by gas inside their schools, and that didn't outrage anyone, despite the fact they were getting punished by the state for participating in the Women Life Freedom movement. Iran is a country in which child marriage is legal. 1,077,000 child brides officially registered in 8 years, including tens of thousands of girls between 10 and 14 who are probably in primary school. And I want to mention that 44 children were killed during the Women Life Freedom movement. And only past month, 200 children were killed. I think that this is horrific. Oh, by the way, 182 girls and women killed each year in the so-called honor killings in Iran, too. I want to mention that we cannot be selective with atrocities. If we see atrocities, and we should definitely mourn and grieve and be upset about them, but not leave the Iranian people alone after, if it's nothing happening by the U.S. or Israel, and never care about what's happening inside the country. I think we need to have solidarity with women and women's movement all over the world under every circumstances, and not brush it under the carpet of cultural relativism or Islamic culture or any of that excuses to continue violence.
Sona, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Sona Kazemi is an assistant professor in the Department of Race, Gender, and Sexuality Studies at UW La Crosse. She was with us to share her perspective on the U.S. and Israel's attacks on Iran and the country she grew up in. Her new book called Disabling Relations documents disabilities due to the violence of war, torture, and other human atrocities.
Coming up, a lawsuit against state lawmakers argues they haven't met their constitutional mandate to provide enough financial support for Wisconsin public schools. Here are two perspectives.
To get them the adequate resources they need, we need to revisit how we fund them.
You've got to go out and get the votes. You don't run to the court to obtain by fiat what you couldn't get democratically.
That's next on WPR News. Last week, five Wisconsin school districts and several other organizations sued the Wisconsin legislature over education funding.
The plaintiffs argue that lawmakers are withholding the funding needed for, quote, the fundamental right of access to an equal opportunity for a sound basic education without tuition. The lawsuit says this means lawmakers are falling short of educational requirements under the state constitution.
Tanya Ketlowski is the superintendent of the Nisida Area School District in central Wisconsin, which is joining that suit. Superintendent Ketlowski, thanks for joining us.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Now, your school district has joined this lawsuit claiming that the state legislature has failed to meet its, quote, constitutionally mandated obligation to provide all children with an equal opportunity for a sound basic education, end quote. That's from the lawsuit. As you see it, how do you see the current funding plans from the legislature failing schools like yours?
Sure. So first of all, in the current funding policy of the state of Wisconsin, student needs are not considered in that policy. And I would argue over my 31 years, I have really seen needs shift of our children. Our children are coming to us with much more significant needs in all different ways. And if the funding formula doesn't equate to the children's needs and it only looks at numbers, I don't think we're adequately helping our kids be the most successful they can be. In terms of special education funding, which of course is a need of our children, we're at 21% or more of students with special needs. And so as we look at that funding, just in the last 10 years, we've been underfunded by over $13 million. And so when I look at our last 2 years or last two operational referenda, 100% of that would have gone to that. So that in and of itself is problematic, but certainly the needs of our kids have shifted. And I think, you know, when you love kids, you're going to, you know, as humble as it may be to sit here talking about it, I need to advocate for them. And I'm going to do it with faith and conviction and do my very best to do what I can do to serve those kids.
Now, somebody could say, hey, this is a policy argument that you can agree or disagree with. A legal violation, in effect, of constitutionally required duties for the legislature. Do you see that as a high bar for you and the other people in the suit to try to meet?
Sure. I mean, I'm not going to deny it. It could be a high bar. But again, I think when you look at when you keep the focus on children, and I don't care where the children reside or go to school or the type of schooling that they want or what their parents choose. It's not about that, because that would throw things into politics. This is really about really just loving children and recognizing the valuable asset they are, and sort of defray from the whole idea that this is about politics. And when we really want to love and support kids, when we have a focus on really supporting the children of our state and of our nation, we're going to find ways to better support their needs. And right now, our current policy does not do that. And I think our children deserve that. We have a lot of special needs kids. We have a lot of needs that are at-risk kids. We have a lot of children of poverty. We have a high needs population. And I think to get them the adequate resources they need, we need to revisit how we fund them.
What remedy are you hoping for from the courts if your lawsuit is successful?
I just hope there's a greater consideration for two things. One is how we look at the needs of children when we determine the final funding of revenue that a district can bring in. And two, I really think we need to look at that, the formula and how we determine what percentage and what portion of the burden of the revenue limit falls on the backs of taxpayers. I live in a high property value district, a very small district, but we're on lakefront property. But I have a very significant high population of citizens that love our kids. They've supported two operational referenda, but they're low and fixed income residents. And that is a majority of our school district. And I just think we have to consider some things that are in addition to property wealth and numbers of kids. There's just more to the story than that. And I think Nisita kind of depicts some of that story.
State lawmakers are still negotiating with Governor Evers over possibly using the state's budget surplus for some combination of property tax relief and funding for schools. Is there an outcome that could come from that that would make you say, okay, now we're pretty good, we don't need this lawsuit?
I wouldn't be doing my justice to suggest that there's a solution that could come out of those current negotiations, because I don't know how everybody would be impacted. What I know is that we have chronic underfunding. And I think that chronic underfunding has put way too much of this tax burden on our local taxpayers. And we have to have a better solution. I think we can champion for children and advocate for taxpayers and ensure that parents have their opportunities of what they want for their children. They are the backbone of society, our families are. And so how can we do this in a way that makes sense? It supports our families, it supports our children, and it supports our local taxpayers to figure out if there are better ways to do things. I think we owe it to our people, our state people, to do that. And I believe when we have strong schools, we're going to have a strong state.
Superintendent Kotlowski, thanks again for joining us.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Tanya Kotlowski is the superintendent of the Nisita Area School District in central Wisconsin. It's one of several groups suing the state legislature over school funding. Now we'll hear from Rick Essenberg, president and general counsel of the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty, also known as WILL. Rick, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me.
Now, Rick, at this point, as we're speaking, you're not representing any party in this suit. That said, as you look at it, as you see the case being made here, what is your reaction to this kind of unusual lawsuit, I think?
Well, you know, I think we have to take a step back. You know, we all love children. We want to educate children. But we live in a democratic republic. And how much to spend on public schools, how that money is to be spent, and how that money is to be raised are political questions. They are questions that our Constitution dictates ought to be made by the legislature and the governor, not by the courts. Our Constitution does not provide that for the usurpation of these decisions by a group of lawyers. And so it's important to understand that the case is, however well-intentioned, really an assault on our democracy, on our way of making decisions democratically. And if you think that more money should be spent on public schools, if you think that the money should be raised in a different way, with the state contributing more perhaps than the local school districts, that's all fine. But your argument is with the legislature. That's where you need to go. And, you know, the fact that you may not get exactly what you want is not a bug, it's a feature of democracy.
The argument in the suit is kind of a chain, says, hey, the Constitution lays out a broad standard of what education should be for Wisconsin kids. And courts and the legislature have interpreted that and implemented that as meaning certain levels of funding that do certain things. And then the lawsuit goes on to say, I'm super shorthanding this, the lawsuit goes on to say, by those standards, via the Constitution, via these interpretations, that's why this is a legal case, because the legislature isn't meeting constitutional and statutory cases they've made in the past. Do you see there being some case there where maybe the courts should be involved in that?
No, I mean, it's absolutely false. I mean, first of all, they go back and they look at some statements that were made during the Constitutional Convention and say, well, gee, the founders wanted 2/3 funding from the state. Well, we've never had, we rarely had in 170 years, 2/3 funding from the state. And that requirement is not in the Constitution. The courts have never and are not well suited to be the ones that run public schools. This is something that is given over to the people and the people's elected representatives. This is something that we have to work out. We don't need to go to, a group of lawyers, wind up being maybe 4 lawyers out of 7, who will dictate how much we have to spend on public schools, how we're going to spend the money that we raise for public schools, and how that money is to be raised. These are simply political questions. They are the stuff of negotiation and compromise.
A thought exercise. Suppose a future combination of governors and lawmakers said, hey, we're going to fund public schools 0. We're going to cut all the funding. Is there a threshold somewhere where you'd say, well, wait a minute, if they're funding at 0, they're not meeting that constitutional call for the state to support education?
Well, sure, in the sense that the Constitution says that, you know, that there have to be district schools. But that doesn't mean that it is now up to courts to decide on the particulars and the details of that. Yes, this is an obligation that the legislature and the governor have. These are things that that we need to work out politically. These are not things that, you know, it's really quite elitist to think that that we will take this decision making from the people of the state of Wisconsin and give it to a group of lawyers. That's not what our Constitution provides for. And I got to say, you know, right now, I think that our, you know, friends on the left side of the political spectrum think that they've got a majority on the court and, you know, they should go for this. But, you know, the way that the law does work is that, precedent matters. And if we decide that public education becomes the province of the courts, I guarantee you that there will be some day when there's a very different majority on that court. And I think that the people who are today advocating for, judicial usurpation of, you know, what our democracy has reserved to the legislature and the governor, they won't like what that conservative majority does. And so I think that this is a time when, as important as this is, that we ought to stick to principle. We ought to understand that process matters, that how we make decisions matter. And this is a decision that is to be made by the people and their elected representatives, not courts.
We'll leave it there. Rick, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Rick Essenberg, president and general counsel of the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. We also heard from Tanya Ketlowski, superintendent of the Nisida Area School District. We've been talking about a lawsuit filed by school districts and others saying state lawmakers are not meeting their constitutional requirements for school funding.
Coming up, a Wisconsin photographer is part of the Tilly Project, helping pet owners capture their ailing pets in the way they remember them in good health.
I'm really looking to show the relationship between the pet parent and the pet.
That's next on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. In a park in Menominee Falls, Erica Mork and her father Stephen walk down a snowy hill with Erica's 12-year-old dog, Cinnamon.
Erica calls her Cinna. They've been together since Cinna was 4 months old. Cinna is a mutt with mostly black and brown fur and white markings around her eyes and mouth.
You have the silliest little underbite and big floppy ears and big bushy eyebrows and just the sweetest old lady.
Now they're shuffling onto a frozen stretch of the Menominee River in frigid weather for a photo shoot.
They're in a snowy park where Erica would walk Cinna back when she was more mobile. Cinna has a cancerous tumor near her knee.
Like, you can even wrap your arm around your daughter. Yes. There we go. There you go. And look at here. Oh. Oh, she liked that one.
Cinna's owners reached out to photographer Haida Hongstermeyer for this photo session. Hongstermeyer is part of the Tilly Project, a global directory for pet owners to connect with end-of-life pet photographers.
According to the Tilly Project, Hongstermeyer is one of about 40 photographers offering free or reduced-cost photo sessions in Wisconsin. And Haida Hongstermeyer joins us now. She is the owner of Wild Iris Photography in Sussex. Haida, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
We just heard some sounds from your photo session with Erica and Stephen Mork and their dog, Cinna. How did that session go?
It was a very cold session. You know, January in Wisconsin can be either gorgeous or quite cold. So it was nice that they struggled with me and made it through. But we had a great cold morning along the Mill Park in Menominee Falls. And Cinna was just a really cute dog. And I mean, both of the family members really loved her a lot. And we captured some of that love.
What techniques do you use to get the most expression out of a pet in these sessions, especially when the dog isn't feeling well?
Yeah. When the dog isn't feeling well, it's very, very difficult because they tend to pin their ears back. And dogs are very expressive in their eyes. So when we have something like that, we focus more on the parent holding them and being really snuggly with them and less on just the pet itself. So I always recommend, like, if people are considering doing a session, that they do one prior to the dog's direct illness where they can see the end coming so that they can share that time when the dog is feeling better or the pet is feeling better with them where we can get some solo pictures and kind of do some fun or maybe artsy things with just the pet alone.
What motivated you to provide end-of-life pet photography? What is that origin story like?
When I started my business, I started it mostly because I had had a dog with hemangiosarcoma, and he passed away when he was 8. And I struggled finding a photographer that would take us and my dog and my young child as photography clients with a reasonable price. And I found that that was very much like, if I have photos with him, I've honored him in some way. And it was important for me to have that honor happen in order to, like, honor him prior to his death.
What photos do you still remember and cherish from that time?
There's one that I took of him in front of our family's, it was our neighbor's garden. They had this gorgeous garden, and it's kind of a profile picture, but we printed it out, and it's hung on our wall ever since. And when my kids were little and he was gone, they would say goodnight to him every night.
And what is he like in the garden?
He's just laying in front of it, and he's kind of looking off in the distance, probably at a squirrel, because his ears were up. He was very attentive. He's a terrier, so really loves those rodents.
that you can't, you know, you can't deny that.
Right. Yeah.
So you offer these free photo shoots for people who come to you with a terminally ill pet. Mm-hmm. What mood are you trying to create through these images?
I'm really looking to show the relationship between the pet parent and the pet. You know, pets are something that we take care of, which means that we put a lot into our efforts with that pet. And because we're constantly taking care of them and they require more care as they get older or as they decline, when they go, there's this huge void. And having these images can really help fill that void in some way. So I'm looking to showcase that love and that connection that they have prior to the void opening.
I wonder, how do you showcase that love through a portrait? How do you capture a pet's personality, the connection with their pet parent in these images?
Yeah, I make a lot of strange noises.
Can you demonstrate?
Oh, boy. It's hard when there's not a pet right in front of me. But the first dog I ever had used to make a very specific noise when her ball went under a radiator and she couldn't get to it. And it went something like, arr! And that almost always will cause a dog to tilt its head and cock its ears upright. So it kind of a instant cute face off of a dog with that noise.
I imagine you've had to work on your sounds over the years.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And I've shot a lot of deaf dogs, too. And they're the hardest because it's really hard to get their attention.
What types of photos do pet owners request from these sessions? What do they want?
I haven't had a lot of direct requests. I think I have a pretty good, you know, we're going to get the dog itself. We're going to get the dog with humans. If there are kids involved, we want to separate and do the pet with the kids. But if the dog has a specific toy that they've always loved or a blanket or something that's really meaningful and they associate with the pet, then we try to break that out and make sure that we get some images with that pet, with that object. Mm.
And this is so bittersweet, right? It has the potential to be so sad, but also such a special moment and celebration of who this pet is. What does the mood tend to be like?
Most of the time, besides pets that are within a couple of days of passing, or they've made an appointment where they're going to euthanize, they're rather joyful sessions. You know, they're sharing their pet with me. I'm asking a lot of questions about the pet. In a way, it's helping that pet live on past life.
Do they keep in touch with you at all after these photo sessions?
Oftentimes they do. Yeah. I always ask, you know, let me know what happens, how they're feeling, what's going on with the pet, because I want to know when that pet passes.
Mm-hmm. What are those exchanges like maybe months later?
They're usually pretty short. Oftentimes the pet parent will reach out and say, you know, we had to put our dog down today, but you know, the gift that you gave us, we really appreciated.
What advice would you give for pet owners who are considering getting photos taken, you know, after their pets get a terminal diagnosis?
I would say better to find somebody and set aside the time to do it earlier or sooner rather than later. You really don't want to wait until the pet doesn't feel very well where you have to make those hard decisions. You want to do it where you're still, where the pet is still able to move on their own and be able to maybe have a little adventure and a special time together.
Haida, what have these dogs taught you?
You know, dogs, they really have a good bond with their owners, and it's really this bond that I'm trying to capture. And sometimes they will bond quickly with me. Sometimes, on a rare occasion, I think I've had like one or two dogs that's kind of like, I don't think I really like you that much. but, you know, they never hold their own emotions back, even though we do, especially in these sessions. Like, the owners will oftentimes not try to be as emotional because that, you know, as humans, sometimes that makes us weak. Whereas the dogs are, if they're feeling good, they are happy and excited to be hanging out and doing something with their people. And if they get treats on top of that, then, you know, bonus.
Treats are always the bonus. Yeah. Haida, thank you for sharing your work and thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for highlighting this. I think the Tilly Project is a great resource, especially for pet parents.
Haida Hangzermeyer is a photographer in Sussex. She's owner of Wild Iris Photography and a member of the Tilly Project. It's a directory connecting pet owners with end-of-life pet photographers in Wisconsin and around the world. Wisconsin Today producers include Lauren Cox, Joe Tarr, and Trevor Hook.
Our technical directors are Tyler Ditter and Sarah Hopeful.
Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.